14. I'm cold. My head hurts. I can smell blood, mine, mixed with the odors of burning wood and distilling alcohol. I fight against shivering, a sure sign of being conscious. The sharp sting on my backside reveals I'm seated in snow, hands bound behind my back, head lolled toward the ground. There are voices, men and women, but none close enough to hear clearly, and not nearly enough to suggest Boone and his men are still here. "They've gone after your friends." The voice comes from my right, and I have little doubt it's the man I clubbed. The fake accent is gone, replaced by one that sounds more southwestern, though it's hard to say. When I don't respond, he says, "I know you're awake. We've both been taught the same tricks. You flinched when you came to." Definitely ex-military, probably special forces. "Why are you here?" I ask, without lifting my head or opening my eyes. "You really want to do this now? You have someplace else to be?" "We both do," he says, revealing his concern for the people with whom he broke into synergy, and as near as I can tell with whom he kicked off this unholy mess. "And I nearly had my hands free before you decided to pistol whip me. I had someplace to be before you blew up my truck." He says nothing, which is admission of guilt enough for me. "You want the truth?" he asks. "Why would I want anything else?" He sighs. "You've gone through life thinking you're on the side of angels. You fight other people's wars. You kill who needs killing. You like to think you don't have a taste for it, but here you are, carrying a gun and wearing a uniform that gives you license to kill in the right circumstances." "Like when someone blows up my truck?" "You're missing the point," he says. "You're a soldier, a good soldier. You don't question your orders, the mission, or the people in charge. You're loyal to a fault, and your loyalty is misplaced." He's attempting to paint himself as the good guy, like corporate espionage can be justified. "Not sure how that's any different from being a soldier of fortune," I say, guessing that he's a mercenary. "Only one of us is paid to be here," he says, "and it would take a lot more than $75,000 a year with benefits to compromise my integrity." If the man knows my salary, he likely knows everything else there is to know about me. In that regard, he has me at a disadvantage. "Then what are you supposed to be?" To folks in the United States, the Minutemen who fended off Britain's armies using guerrilla tactics are legendary heroes. You were a raider. You understand what they did and how they did it better than most. You respect it, emulate it, improve upon it. If we were 100 years further back in time, you'd be fighting right alongside them. Without the Minutemen, the freedom we enjoy wouldn't have been possible. I think we can both agree on that. I say nothing. He knows enough about me that I don't need to. But to the British, they were something else. The Minutemen fought without honor, without respect for the code of war. They struck at random, caused chaos, struck fear in all those loyal to the crown. So you're a terrorist. Only if you're a redcoat, it's a matter of perspective. The people you work for with big fucking blinders on are not worth protecting. I agree with his theory, but not necessarily with his conclusions. While it's true that I don't know the exact nature of Synergy's research, I know they've done right by me and my community, and they will continue to do so. As long as we feel a need, I think. In a painful flash, I realize I might have fallen into a modern version of the trap that ensnared so many people in coal country. But that doesn't make Synergy a target for corporate terrorism. They might be just another soulless corporation, but aside from the grumbling of locals still loyal to their previous master, I haven't heard any complaints about the company, any negative news reports, and have never had to fend off protesters. What have they done that's so bad? "We're in the damn past," the man says through grinding teeth. He's losing his patience. "We're tearing through it, shattering it. Have you even considered what the ramifications of all this might be? Outside of your own death, I mean? Try to forget for a moment that you're a grunt. Focus on the big picture, on the thousands of what-if scenarios. For all we know, this is happening all over the planet. Our world could be tearing itself apart, and you're worried about what, Cassie?" "You know a lot about me," I say, taking some comfort in the fact that he doesn't seem to know my father and younger self were on this mountain, being whisked through time alongside us, and a growing collection of violent, long-dead Appalachians. "But there are a few things you don't know." Try me, he says. I've been awake for 15 minutes. I turn toward him for the first time. He's seated beside me, still wearing his black pants and t-shirt, his head stained with blood from where I struck him. He meets my gaze, unflinching. And? I draw my hands out from behind my back, shedding the rope used to tie me in place. Then he surprises me by revealing his own hands. These assholes have no idea how to tie a knot. Tension swells between us. We both have reasons to attack the other, but that would only get us shot. The only way out of our predicament is to work together, and we both know it, no matter how much we don't like it. As we both set to work, covertly untying our feet, I ask, "You got a name?" "You can call me Minuteman." "Cute," I say. "I'll just call you Owen." He's goading me, knowing I can't react. "You're kind of a dick. I've been told." He slips the loosened ropes up and over his toes and then leans back, sitting like he's still bound. My efforts take a little longer because I'm doing my best to appear unconscious, which means moving very slowly. Minuteman is mostly hidden behind me, affording him a little more freedom of mobility. "Despite what you think, I'm not your enemy." He sounds sincere, but he's no doubt been trained in the art of deception just like me. Part of modern guerrilla warfare is working your way into an existing community, gaining their trust, and recruiting them to fight alongside you. The more people you convert to the cause, the greater your chances of success. It's a technique I've used several times in the past without flaw. Until Boone. "And despite what you think," I say, "I'm not a killer. These people might be the ancestors of people I know from our time." "Pretty sure a paradox is the least of our worries," Minuteman says. "If it will help you sleep better, I'll try not to kill them. But if they don't leave me a choice..." I nod. I've made the same call several times already today. "I get it." "Do you?" he asks. "Here's the real difference between us. The only value my life has over these people is that they can't stop what's happening." "And you can. I know to try. By killing a bunch of scientists at Synergy?" "I have zero doubt that was the original plan. Search and destroy. Equipment and personnel. First, I'm gonna help them undo all this shit. Then, I suppose that depends on whether or not they've learned their lesson." "And the people who try to stop you?" I ask, thinking of my crew still inside the facility. "My friends." He shrugs. "You know the deal. It's not personal. But I am giving you a chance to do the right thing. We could walk through the gate together instead of me blowing it up." It's a tempting offer, but without a way to confirm anything he's said, it's possible he's just running a con game on me. In his position, I'd do the same. Hell, we're about to run one together, but that's where our collusion comes to an end. His goal includes causing harm to the people I've promised to protect. That puts us at odds, even if we want the same outcome, to be returned to the present. "You ready?" he asks. In answer to his question, I flop onto my side and start spasming, making sure to keep my feet together and my hands behind my back. With all the movement, it's unlikely anyone will notice the ropes are missing. "Hey!" Minuteman shouts. "Someone help him!" Voices rise. A handful of men and women hobble over, their feet slipping through the mud created by burning fires and melting snow. But they don't lend a hand or even get close enough to attack. They simply form a semicircle around us and laugh at my misfortune. "Look at him go!" a man shouts, "like a fish with a hook in him!" One laugh is louder than the rest, closer than the rest. I open my eyes to find a beast of a woman standing just 3 feet away. She's dressed in a trench coat. My trench coat. Well, the coat I took from a dead man 2 hours ago and 30 years from now. What I don't see on her or anyone else is my P-220. But there is little doubt about who has the gun. Boone might not have been impressed by me or my story, but he had eyes for the pistol. Ultimately, that might have been my undoing. Immediate satisfaction of greed can sometimes outweigh the long-term benefits of patience. Knowing my chances aren't going to get any better than they are right now, I shove my feet off the ground as hard as I can, spinning my body around. Laughter commingles with gasps. And then, before anyone can react, I kick out hard, connecting with a woman's knee. The crack of bone and the scream that follows silences the laughter entirely. In the brief respite that follows, I hear the sound of distant gunfire. Then our fight starts.